It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We're going to expand our flavor horizons and learn about some new ways to mix and match ingredients with the author of The Flavor Thesaurus. First, we humans can be strongly affected by traumatic experiences that happen early in life. And we're not alone. Other mammals, including baboons and hyenas, have shown long-term effects of early trauma. In humans and some other primates, adverse childhood experiences are associated with a lot of health problems in adulthood and even, in some cases, an earlier death. But gorillas seem to be an exception. New long-term research has found that gorillas, which are one of humans' closest living relatives, don't seem to suffer so much from long-term negative outcomes of childhood trauma. In fact, male gorillas that have experienced three or more adverse experiences early in life tend to live longer. We're looking at this new research on gorillas, why they may hold clues to how trauma works in humans. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question for our guest about this research, that's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Robin Morrison is an affiliate scientist at the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund and a senior researcher at the University of Zurich, where she studies gorilla behavior and evolutionary biology. Robin, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Can you talk at first about the scope of this research? This is long-term, a large population of gorillas. Tell us a little bit about that, please.
Yes. So this is the population of gorillas that has been monitored since the late 60s. So they were first started being studied by Diane Fossey 55 years ago. And so we're very lucky to then be able to use all of this data that's been collected over the last 55 years about these individual gorillas' lives to understand how what happens to them early on then affects them later on in their lives.
And talk a little bit about the sorts of early events you were looking for, and then, as you say, tracing later in the gorillas' lives.
Yes, so we wanted to look at things that were kind of good parallels for things that can happen in humans and also things that have been studied in other species as well, so other animals. For gorillas, bad things that can really happen to them are things like losing their mother. That's a big one because, you know, she's their most important social contact. She's kind of there fighting their corner in every interaction they go through. So maternal loss is a big one. Also paternal loss. So fathers do a lot if you're a gorilla. They're very caring, and they provide a lot of protection as well. So losing a father can be really bad. Also things like group instability. So if your group breaks apart, if you have a sibling that's very close in age with you that perhaps you have to compete with a lot, or one of the big things in gorillas is actually quite violent interactions between these groups. So some young gorillas experience quite extreme violence at a very early age, perhaps losing one of their siblings through kind of a violent attack from another gorilla. So all of these sorts of things can happen to young gorillas. So they do have a lot of potentially very traumatic events going on in their early lives.
When we look at these gorillas who had these traumatic events early in life, what did you learn about their outcomes, about how they developed later in life?
So we were really quite shocked when we looked at kind of the long-term survival outcomes of these individuals, especially the ones that suffered from a lot of early life trauma. What we found was that unlike all kind of other species where this has been looked at in detail, in the gorillas, they seemed to be doing quite well. And actually, those that experienced the most traumatic events in early life were somehow surviving the longest. So this was really polar opposite to what we were seeing in other species.
Why? Do we have a sense of why that might be? Why gorillas would be so different?
I mean, I think that's the million-dollar question. So we've got some ideas, but we don't yet know. And really, we're looking at kind of what is different about these gorillas compared to other animals, compared to humans. What's going on that could help them overcome this early life adversity? And there are two things that really stick out to us. One is that in this habitat, these gorillas are living off, they're kind of feeding on all of this vegetation that's all around them. So we like to say that they eat salad and they're living in a salad bowl. Basically everything around them they can eat. And these foods are available year round. There's very little variation and there's not a lot of competition for getting them. So they have access to these kind of readily available foods all year round. So there's very little variation in that. So that's one theory we have. The second theory is all about their kind of social groups. So we know they live in these really supportive, really cohesive social groups. And one thing we've examined is if a young gorilla loses their mother, who's their most important kind of social relationship, what we see is that all the other gorillas in the group really strengthen their bond with that individual, especially the dominant male. And so rather than kind of becoming a social outcast, they become really central in their group and they have a lot of social support from other individuals. So our theories are that it's this availability of food, this reliable availability of food, and also these really kind of cohesive, supportive social groups. So it could be both, it could be either, and we really want to dig into what could be going on.
Talking to Robin Morrison, affiliate scientist at the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund and senior research at the University of Zurich, looking at research on early trauma for gorillas and what it might mean for other species. And Robin, obviously part of the research is to understand gorillas themselves. You said at the beginning, also we're comparing and contrasting with other species, including humans. What kind of either lessons or questions does your research raise for you about other primate species?
I think when we look at what's going on in baboons, so baboons have this crazy, crazy opposite reaction. So in baboons, we see individuals that are living, that are experiencing a lot of adversity and surviving half as long. And when we compare that with gorillas, we see the opposite going on. So one thing that's really different between these two species is where they live. So their habitat is very different. So that is potentially one clue of as to what's going on there when we compare with other primates. I think really the possible lesson from this research for kind of humans and maybe other primates too, is that it might be kind of not just providing resources, but also making sure we're providing social support, and that potentially these two things in combination are really important for helping individuals through early life adversity and kind of buffering them to these long-term effects. But we don't know this yet for sure. And so this is really what we're going to be digging into next to really understand how we can take this and kind of learn what important things there are to learn that apply to potentially humans too.
Now, one interesting difference in humans, and we'll be talking about this with our next guest in a bit, childhood trauma is often linked to risky health behaviors, smoking or heavy drinking. Well, I don't imagine that's an issue for gorillas, for example. But what kind of what do you think this tells us maybe about how trauma might affect gorillas and humans differently?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting idea. I mean, humans obviously have all of these kind of risky health behaviors, things like gambling and smoking, like you said, and gorillas really don't have a parallel, but perhaps there are other behaviors that are risky if you're a gorilla. So maybe kind of your willingness to start fights with other gorilla groups, or perhaps you're gambling on, you know, whether you're going to be able to entice some females from another group into your group. There are kind of aspects of that kind of potentially risky behavior that could be a parallel in gorillas, and something that we should look into in the future to see whether that sort of thing is going on in gorillas. And it's maybe possible that that could actually have benefits in gorillas in ways that it doesn't necessarily in humans.
To what extent do we see big personality differences among a group of gorillas?
I think personality really is a big part of the variety of behaviors. When you see enough gorillas in the wild, you really get to know, you know, some of them are quite shy, some of them are quite timid, some of them are very, very family oriented. And there is a really wide variety of kind of personalities going on in these male gorillas, and also in the females too, and kind of what their preferences are. I think personality does have a big part of kind of the variation in behavior that we see day to day working with these gorillas.
And Robin, as we wrap up, what is your next step, your next big question when it comes to the impact of early trauma for adult gorillas?
So the next things we really want to do are look into kind of how early life trauma influences their social behavior across their lives, whether they're kind of interacting differently with other individuals because of this early life trauma. And then we also want to tie this to kind of what's going on hormonally for them. Are there differences hormonally for the gorillas that had a lot of early life trauma? Are they potentially responding differently to things like stresses in their environment? And could that offer clues as to potentially how gorillas are so resilient to early life adversity whilst other species aren't necessarily?
Robin, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Robin Morrison, affiliate scientist of the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund and senior researcher at the University of Zurich, where she studies gorilla behavior and evolutionary biology. She talked to us about her research, finding that gorillas appear to be more resilient to early life trauma than many other primates and other mammals. Coming up, a Wisconsin researcher tells us what we know about the impact of adverse childhood experiences here in the state and what we can do about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about how adverse childhood experiences affect people later in life? Have you experienced problems yourself in adulthood because of this? Do you work with kids? What kind of things do you see? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about how traumatic experiences early in life can carry negative repercussions years later in adulthood. Adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, include things like physical, emotional, or sexual abuse, neglect, living with someone with substance abuse disorder, and having an incarcerated parent. A higher number of adverse childhood experiences is correlated with negative health outcomes, sometimes even earlier death. But our next guest says with the right treatments and interventions, it doesn't have to be that way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you and your life story? What do you want to know about how trauma can affect our brains and bodies? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Dipesh Nafzaria is an associate professor of pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and clinical associate professor of human development and family studies at the UW School of Human Ecology. Dr. Nafzaria, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much. I'm pleased to be here again.
As you listened to Robin Morrison's research, in this case on gorillas, did anything ring a bell or sound familiar with the work you've done on adverse childhood experiences in us humans?
Yes. Gosh, there was so much there. And I think it just highlights how much we can all gain from studying other species, including other primates, to learn more about us humans as well. I think the thing that stuck out to me was this hypothesis that perhaps gorillas that had a higher ACE score, that had more of these adverse experiences, were actually developing better social connections, because we see this very clearly in humans, that one of the strongest protective factors that children have against adversity is what we call relational health, the strength of their relationships with others. And that has a deeply protective effect. So if that hypothesis comes to be shown to be likely true, I think it underscores what we're seeing in so many humans.
I listed some of the different examples of adverse childhood experiences. What kind of problems do those early experiences bring about? What kind of problems are they correlated with later in life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's well known that there are a lot of issues that do happen when humans have higher numbers of adverse experiences as children, and how it appears in each person can be very different and very variable depending on them as individuals as well as external factors around them. So it can lead to problems with behavior, mental health, which is obviously tied in with behavior, physical health. Even we see higher rates of chronic disease like heart disease and so on when there's higher ACE scores. And so forth. But I think what's important to recognize is that so many of these things can be mitigated mm-hmm. through what we're now calling PCEs, positive childhood experiences. So we can mitigate these effects in childhood by providing ample, safe, stable, supportive, and nurturing relationships. And even if they happened, the adversity happened, there is treatment that can be done later on, but we need to look for it. We need to identify it, and we need to make sure that adequate treatment is available with a good evidence base for it.
I've seen you give presentations on adverse childhood experiences, and that's, I think, one of the main things I took away is that, you're not doomed to these outcomes of adverse mm-hmm. childhood experiences. How are we doing, though, mm-hmm. at getting these kind of detections and interventions in place to help those kids overcome those adverse childhood experiences?
It continues to be a challenge. I think as a society, we are very much not all that interested in prevention. We are more interested in trying to treat issues afterwards, which is much more costly and takes a lot more resources. So I think that that's pretty consistent for a lot of things, and it's true with adversity as well. We need to recognize that we all end up paying for it, both literally in terms of dollars as well as the emotional and other lost talent costs to society when we don't get it right. But I do think there's something to trying to balance out the notion of adversity, which I think, we've been talking about so much in the last decade in particular, to also then say, but we should also be focusing on a strengths-based approach. What is there, and how do we protect and promote that and recognize how powerful those positive experiences are in trying to balance out the adversity, the effects of adversity.
Talking to Wisconsin doctor Dipesh Nafsaria about adverse childhood experiences and positive experience for kids, how they balance out, how they affect kids down the road, even into adulthood. Dr. Nafsaria, what do we know about how these ACEs, these adverse childhood experiences, can affect a kid's brain and nervous system?
Yeah, the brain of a young child is so fascinating because human beings are born relatively helpless. Our brains are not fully formed. And the reason for that is that if you allow that brain to reach the same level of development that it does in other mammals, the head would be too big, right? You wouldn't be able to be born, and that would not be compatible with the species surviving. So the compromise, so to speak, is to have a relatively helpless baby being born, and then spending the first, certainly the first year, and well beyond through the first 5 years of life, where that brain is finishing up a lot of that quote unquote basic wiring that needs to happen. And this represents both an opportunity and a threat. The opportunity is that if we give good, supportive, nurturing environments, that brain wires for language, for learning, for love, and for literacy. And if we don't provide great environments, that brain wires for threats, for scarcity, for safety, for things like that. So the choice is ours as a society. What inputs are we going to provide for those young children?
Now, maybe this is a fine point. I might use adverse childhood experience and the word trauma interchangeably, and I think I'm wrong when I do that, Dr. Nafsaria. Trauma is kind of what follows the event, and we can kind of shape that in some ways. Could you talk about that distinction?
I don't know if this is necessarily a distinction. I think it depends on how people are discussing it. I would say that trauma is adversity, and adversity is trauma. I think the aftereffects, the post-traumatic situation is certainly different, and that can look different in different individuals over time.
Part of your work, Dr. Nafsaria, is to bring these things to the attention of doctors and other healthcare providers around the state to be aware of these adverse childhood experiences. What kind of things are you doing? What kind of things are you encouraging healthcare providers to do?
What we're really talking about now is assessing early relational health. Again, what's the health of relationships with that family? Because we know that if every child has a deep, deep need to have at least one, we hope more than one, but at least one safe, stable, supportive, nurturing relationship in their life. So, how do we assess that? How do we assess the health of children and families and how they interact with each other and how they support one another? And if we can, and we can do that within just a few minutes as part of regular checkups, and we can either support and protect and promote what they're already doing right, or we can help kind of offer guidance where we maybe see some places where it could use and benefit from some improvement, or to do that repair work if things have already started to go downhill. Because trauma does that, it frays those relationships. So if we can actually offer routes to be able to do all those things, the prevention work as well as the repair work where necessary, we're going to see big payoffs.
Are there things we can do to help the people raising children, parents or other guardians to take care of kids to help prevent these adverse childhood experiences and to have these strong positive connections?
I think the number one thing is that when we work with children and families is I'm going to throw in a quote from Ted Lasso here, right? Be curious, not judgmental. Be curious about what they're saying about their child. When they make an observation that you find puzzling, right? Like, oh, my child is mean. Really? What? Tell me more about that. What makes you say that, right? Because maybe it's something we can help them reinterpret or get a new vision or new perspective on in different ways. And then being supportive about how difficult parenting is. Parenting is a challenging task, and acknowledging that and then saying that you believe in their ability to do it, right? A lot of it is bolstering the confidence of parents. I think all parents don't feel confident at some point about the job they're doing as a parent. I know I don't. And my kids are in college and they would still probably tell you that I get it wrong sometimes. So if we can do that sort of work to help support parents in that role, I think we'll see very big payoffs there in terms of reducing all these things.
It's a good place to leave it, Dr. Nafzaria. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That's Dr. Dipesh Nafzaria, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and Clinical Associate Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at the UW School of Human Ecology. He talked to us about the lifelong impact of adverse childhood experiences and ways to counter that impact. Earlier, we heard from researcher Robin Morrison with the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund looking at her research on early trauma and why gorillas look different from a lot of species with how they respond to that in the long run. Coming up after the news, our guest shares new and sometimes surprising flavor combinations, things like sesame and chocolate or cumin and yogurt. On this week's edition of Food Friday, we want to hear from you your favorite combination of two or more flavors. Maybe something that you found surprising the first time you had it or used it. Let us know right now on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new package of bills in the state legislature aims to fix the shortage of affordable housing here in Wisconsin with incentives for new construction and renovation. We get more of the details from one of the lawmakers who co-sponsored those bills. Now it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Think about great flavor combinations, things that go together naturally. Some standbys might leap to mind of peanut butter and jelly, pork and beans. But our next guest will take us on a much wider journey of flavor combos. How about maple syrup and fennel or sesame and chocolate? We'll get some recommendations for new imaginative pairings to try, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are some of the best but maybe also unusual food pairings you've come across or come up with yourself? What's a food or flavor you can't stand by itself, but partner it up with just the right thing? You can't get enough of it. What makes a great flavor pairing in your opinion? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nikki Segnet is the author of Lateral Cooking and The Flavor Thesaurus. Her latest book, just out this week, is called The Flavor Thesaurus, More Flavors, Plant-Led Pairings, Recipes, and Ideas for Cooks. Nikki, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Now, for people who aren't familiar with the premise of your original Flavor Thesaurus book, this is not your standard issue cookbook with recipes that we have to follow to the letter. What is it that you're setting out to do with your Flavor Thesaurus of combos?
Well, what I wanted to do was make a book about why flavors work together and to give a kind of a broad range of ideas of what we might try. So a lot of the book is it's classic combinations, but there's also lots of kind of interesting things or things that are borrowed from other cultures. And it all comes together in, I think both books have about just under 1,000 pairings each. And the back will give you a quick reference list. So if you've got something in your fridge that you want to use up, you can just have a look at that and it gives you a list of things. But then each one has a page reference and you can turn to the front and you'll get an elaboration on that pairing. It might tell you something interesting. It might give you a recipe. It might just give you some slightly off the wall tidbit of information.
One of the things you're hoping to accomplish, apart from inspiring us to try cool flavor combinations, is cut back on food waste. So if we've got a little bit of ingredient X that we had left over from that one recipe, we could look it up in the book and see what things go with it and throw something together. Is that kind of how you cook at home?
I mean, it completely is, or it's a lot more how I wanted to cook when I set out to write the first one, because it was just happening to me all the time, because all the cooking that I was doing was led by recipes and recipe books. I didn't know how to kind of freestyle. So I wanted to kind of teach myself, but also in teaching myself, help other people understand kind of what they might do with half a packet of French beans or, you know, some lentils that are sitting in the back of the cupboard. And I don't know about in where you are, but here in the UK, food prices have gone crazy. And it's just more useful than ever not to throw anything away.
In this new book now, you're focusing more on plant-led pairings. You say, is that a vegan book? Not even necessarily intended to be a vegetarian book. But what led you to want to tackle the plant world of flavors in particular?
Well, simply that when I wrote the first book, and it was quite a hit straight away. It started to sell a lot of copies. And I was doing events and people were coming up to me and saying, oh, I wish you'd included zucchini. I wish you'd included this. I wish you'd done lentils. And just about everything that people wanted me to write about, there'd be plants. There were lots of gardeners who had gluts of things. There were people who were shopping in the market who would find that, you know, there were things on offer that they wanted to use. And that was mainly plants. The only thing that I hadn't covered already, I mean, there's all the meat and fish that's in the other book, in the first book. There was only duck that I hadn't covered. And much as I like duck, it would have been kind of strange to write about 91 ingredients and one type of meat. It just wouldn't seem right. So anyway, it just seemed like a really interesting way of understanding a bit more about plants is to make it plant-led. And like you say, it's not a vegan book or a vegetarian book, but it's definitely plant-forward.
Now, you've got a recipe for us, even though, again, the book isn't mostly recipes. It's in French. I'll give it a shot. Tarte au sucre. We've got this at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now, the pairing, this combination, maple syrup, I love maple syrup, and fennel. I have mixed feelings about fennel. Talk about the combination of those two flavors, please.
Well, this might be an interesting one for you to try, because actually it uses quite a small amount of fennel.
Okay.
Because one of the things that is interesting to me about writing about maple syrup is, A, it has an incredible flavor, and it has so much flavor that maple syrup has its own flavor wheel. And so it makes it an interesting ingredient and quite an easy ingredient to write about. But here in the UK, maple syrup is very expensive. And so you don't want to pair it with anything that undermines the beauty of the maple syrup itself. And one of the flavors that maple syrup, particularly the darker sort, has naturally is fennel. So I made a tart, which is based on, it's Canadian French, actually, isn't it? Tarte au sucre, sugar tart. And I made it based on a very kind of old English treacle tart recipe. And it's mainly just maple syrup and breadcrumbs in a tart case, but with just a tiny bit of fennel on the top. And all it does is it picks up on the natural fennel flavor in the syrup, but it adds a tiny bit of freshness that stops all that kind of sweetness becoming too much, you know, you get to a point where actually the palate gets a bit tired of things that are very, very sweet. And the fennel just, it's like opening a window a little bit in a hot room.
I've got something like that. And Wisconsin, Nikki, I don't know if you know, makes the best maple syrup in the world. You can ignore the Canadians and Vermonters and things like that. I came across a drink some time ago that had maple syrup and lemon in it. Now I use that in a lot of cocktails and mocktails. And that is that doing the same kind of premise there you just mentioned, you know, having something a little tangier, a little sharper to go along with that sort of potentially cloying flavor of maple syrup?
I mean, it absolutely would. The only problem for me is we have a product here called Golden Syrup. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. I've never seen it.
I did in your
States.
Book.
You heard it in the book. Yeah. I mean, I've never seen it for sale in the States, but it's a byproduct of the sugar refining process. And it's got a really nice flavor. It's got like a toffee flavor with a kind of citric note to it. And that's what we use for that kind of tart a lot of the time. But it's a quarter of the price. Mm. So when I tried maple syrup with lemon, it tasted so much like golden syrup. And it kind of slightly undermines a lot of the natural beauty of the maple syrup. I'm not saying it's not nice, but you know, if you can get golden syrup, you might be able to do the job for less of your dollars.
We're talking to Nikki Segnet on this edition of Food Friday. She's the author of the book Lateral Cooking, and she has the Flavor Thesaurus. Her new book is an expansion on the Flavor Thesaurus, more flavors, plant-led pairings, recipes, and ideas for cooks. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What two flavors to you are, if I can steal from the commercials, two great tastes that taste great together? What is a favorite pairing that you like to bring together, even either within one dish or drink, or two different dishes in the same meal? Is there something that you like combined together that other people look and you say, what now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from James on the Facebook page. Nikki, this is interesting. A vanilla ice cream. Now, you talk a lot about vanilla in the book. And sriracha, that I don't know if this is big in the UK, but you know sriracha, the hot pepper sauce. Yeah. You've got a vanilla and I think peppercorn combo in there. What's the idea behind combining a vanilla and something a little spicy?
Well, I mean, the thing is, the vanilla ice cream, we're so used to it as a kind of almost like a neutral background, and it's got sugar and it's got fat. So it kind of has a bit of magic to it. It tends to make things, you know, everything tastes kind of nice. I have not tried it with sriracha. That is a new one on me, but I always say never, and I will give it a go. With the vanilla and peppercorn in the book, that is often that's being paired in ways like using a vanilla fudge. And it's just using the peppercorn to give a bit of heat and a bit of kind of slight woodiness. So if you actually taste, I mean, we don't really often think about what black pepper tastes like. We just kind of grind it on and maybe kind of just kind of accept what it is. But actually, if you really taste it, it's got quite a strong pine flavor to it, a bit pine, you know, of the wood pine, and a tiny bit of fruitiness to it. So I think that added to a vanilla, it kind of takes the vanilla natural flavor and just broadens it out a bit. It's quite a natural pairing. You wouldn't necessarily know where one starts and one stops.
And now here, you know, sometimes we use vanilla as a slang for boring, right? Or bland. And if I'm reading you right, Nikki, you don't agree with that assessment. You see a lot of use and a lot of range for vanilla.
I mean, it's definitely not bland. It is. I mean, I think the reason that we use it in that way, in that kind of calling things vanilla, is just because vanilla is so ubiquitous. People like it so much. And because we associate it with the flavor of ice cream, our brain kind of brings that ice cream or cake, you know, it brings that association with it. So when we taste things that have got vanilla in them, which is a surprising number of things that you wouldn't expect to have vanilla in them, then we naturally feel warmer towards it, like it a bit more, because it's pinging something in our brain, even if that's at a subconscious level.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to author Nikki Segnet about her new book, The Flavor Thesaurus, more flavors, plant-led pairings, recipes, and ideas for cooks. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about combinations of flavors? Are her pairing ideas so far giving you some inspiration? Do you cook this way? Hey, I think this is going to taste good with that, and I'm going to wing it without a recipe. And do you have a favorite combination of flavors that's your go-to for a meal or a dessert? Does it strike other people as odd until they try it? After they try it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with author Nikki Segnet on this edition of Food Friday. Her new book is called The Flavor Thesaurus: More Flavors, Plant-Led Pairings, Recipes, and Ideas for Cooks. She has a zillion combos, plus or minus, of flavor combinations and how they work, why they work together. You could join in with your favorites at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Kathy is with us in Oak Creek. Kathy, hi.
Hey, Rob. So I like to put peanut butter. I like the natural kind with no sugar and the pizza peppers, those little pepper flakes that you put in your pizza.
Uh-huh.
And I stir that in the peanut butter, and then I like to put raw onion on there. It sounds really weird, but it's really good, and especially on a bagel.
It doesn't sound weird to me, Kathy. I use peanut butter sometimes on savory kind of sandwiches myself. What first led you to try that?
I was looking for something healthier than peanut butter and jelly.
Kathy, thank you so much. Now, peanut butter, I think in your book, your new book, Nikki, makes just a guest appearance. This is the word I'm looking for. But peanut sauce and peanut butter on savory things, it shows up in a lot of cuisines around the world. Kathy's ideas are not so weird there, are they?
That's right. I mean, peanut is in the first book, so that one covers a whole load of things that aren't necessary in the new one. I think that when I was writing the first Flavor of the Thesaurus, there was this thing going around where people used to say bacon goes with everything. And that might be true to the people who eat bacon, but there's a lot of people who don't eat bacon. And the thing that really does seem to go with everything is peanuts and peanut butter. I mean, you will see it in just all sorts of guises. And when I do things like this and phone-ins, it's nearly always peanut butter that comes up as something that people like to have with something that sounds quite unusual. So obviously there's peanut butter with like burger pickles, dill pickles. I don't know what you call them there. Peanut butter with mint leaves.
Interesting. And yeah, Kathy had peanut butter and onions, which I had thought of. Peanut butter with lime mixed in can make a great sauce. What is it about peanut butter? Why is it so versatile?
Well, I think the thing is that peanuts, particularly, you know, if you've got some that you're going to add a little bit of salt, they've got, again, they're salty, they're fatty, they've got a lot of flavor because we're talking about peanuts that have been roasted. We're not talking about the raw sort. And the roasting process brings up loads of flavor in them. So it makes them kind of, it gives them, if you'll forgive me, it gives them a slight meatiness, it gives them richness, it gives them roasted flavors and stuff, all things that we find as just, you know, as human animals, very, very tasty indeed. And I think, you know, there is that idea as well that when something is very tasty and also feels quite healthy to us, it makes it taste even better.
Thanks a lot for that call, Kathy. Nancy joins us now in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I'd like to tell you that I drink a lot of chocolate whey protein powder or chocolate plant protein powder. And quite often I mix it with some milk. But I do find that when I mix it with apple juice, it is just wonderful. That you have the full rich chocolate flavor, but you have the tang of the apple. It is just a marvelous drink. And you're getting this protein without having to cook something.
Nancy, thanks a lot for that call. So, of course, chocolate and milk, I think we think of as a common pairing. What about that chocolate and, in this case, apple juice or apples, Nikki? Is that a combo you've looked at?
It is a combo I've looked at because we have a really famous chocolate here that people buy at Christmas called a chocolate orange. And it's the shape of an orange and it falls into segments. And before there was the chocolate orange, there was the chocolate apple. Now, the difference was that the chocolate apple wasn't flavored apple. It was just the shape. The thing is with chocolate is it's going to, as a rule, it's going to really flatten out an apple's flavor because apple, you know, you're not going to get it. It won't peek through the chocolate flavor so much. So what I think you're getting is you're getting a kind of, if you like, generic fruity tang that comes through that might be nice, might lighten up the chocolate some, but you're not necessarily going to be able to tell, you know, it's not like the kind of combination where you'd be able to tell what kind of apple it was, whether it was a red apple or whether it was a very tangy apple. You just get, you just get sort of fruitiness really.
Nancy, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. It's Food Friday. We're talking to Nikki Segnet about her new book, The Flavor Thesaurus, More Flavors, Plant-Led Pairings, Recipes, and Ideas for Cooks. Nikki, a very timely thing. People are planting their gardens here in Wisconsin, as I did. And in about 2-3 months, the most common online search term will be zucchini recipe, or what to do with zucchini, or how to safely dispose of zucchini. You've got a section on zucchini in the new book. What goes with the flavor of zucchini, / is there a flavor of zucchini?
Well, there is, but there is the flavor of zucchini, and most of the good part of the zucchini flavor is in the skin, which is why, gardeners are really the lucky people, because they can pick those zucchini when they're still really small and the skin to flesh ratio is really high. And it's lovely when you can get a bit of a char on it, whether you're griddling it or grilling it. Something it takes very kindly to that, and actually the texture is very nice too. The thing is with the inside, like all squash, really, it's got those seeds, and they can become quite rustic tasting, in not necessarily the nicest possible way. So if they get big, they start to taste a bit like rainwater that you might have collected in your in your water butt. So it's quite subtle. So, of course, I think one of the obvious ways, and one of the ways that you might learn to cook zucchini if you do garden, is to make the Marcella Hazan zucchini fries with garlic, because obviously the garlic kind of takes away any of that slight rustic taste. But zucchini fries, I mean, I'm not terribly sure anyone could ever get bored of them. But if you do, the thing to do is probably go to the cheesemonger. And, you know, courgettes and cheese, there's so many different ways that you can cook them together. But my favorite, and I do like to practice my souffle skills, but courgette and cheese makes a really great souffle.
What are some cheeses that taste, do you think, particularly good with zucchini? Because we also have, in addition to maple syrup, some cheese here in Wisconsin.
Sorry, what's that?
What kind of cheeses pair well with zucchini?
Well, obviously, Wisconsin cheeses pair really well. I think I've been to Wisconsin, and I believe people wear cheese on their heads.
They do.
Often we would be making something like a souffle, then you're going to want something that's like a Gruyere, maybe teased up a bit with some Parmesan, but you can definitely use cheddar in the same place. But Gruyere would be the absolute ideal in that case. But you may know of a famous Greek dish called spanakopita, which is a mixture of spinach and feta in phyllo pastry. Well, courgettes can stand in for the spinach. So it's a lovely kind of mixture of sliced courgettes and crumbled feta with lots of buttery phyllo. It makes a beautiful pie. A really great meal, a really great supper with a glass of wine. You could make them into courgette fritters, but use chickpea flour instead of like ordinary plain flour. And that way you get kind of quite a slightly rougher texture, but you also get a slightly sulfurous taste. It's a very pleasant taste with vegetables. I don't know what you call it there. We call it besan here sometimes, which is like the Indian name for it.
I want to get into one more combo that's in your book, and we'll stay with the cheese theme here. Cheese goes well with raisins, you say. Could you talk about using raisins and cheese together as a combo?
Well, I don't know if you do, given that you have quite a strong cheese culture, but here we really like to pair cheese, hard, tangy cheeses, with all sorts of fruitcakes. So I don't know if the culture of regifting fruitcake is quite the same in the States, but people don't tend to get very excited about a fruitcake
right,
at Christmas
here.
Like they used to. But keep it, cut it into slices and eat it with cheese. It's an old tradition in the north of England, and it's absolutely fantastic. Probably because if you think about a lot of the flavors that you get in raisins and in dried fruit are very similar to the flavors that you'll find in something like a Shiraz, a Syrah, a Cote de Rhone, that kind of wine. So you get all those lovely vinous, rich, deep flavors and tannins as well in the dried fruit that work really well with the cheese, because they soften up the cheese and the cheese softens up the fruit, and they just have that lovely kind of reciprocal agreement.
Fantastic. Nikki, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. And I will be trying chocolate and apple juice.
Excellent. That's Nikki Segnet, author of Lateral Cooking and the Flavor Thesaurus. We've been talking about her latest book. It's called The Flavor Thesaurus, More Flavors, Plant-Led Pairings, Recipes, and Ideas for Cooks. You can keep sharing your favorite combos on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Jacqueline there, who says cinnamon or cinnamon rolls with chili. Ooh, I've seen that. And we heard from Greg in Duluth, who says chili powder, not store-bought, and some homemade applesauce. Lots of people have their own cool combinations. Keep sharing yours on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, explore the frontiers of prosthetics and limb replacement and some of the latest medical advances in those fields. And you could share, if you have a story to share in your own life of someone who's received a prosthetic, how have things changed over the years? You could email ideas@WPR.org. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Yesterday on the show, we talked about familects, as in family dialects, those unique words and phrases that families come up with or groups of friends maybe develop over time. You shared some great stories. We heard more on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Joy writes, we celebrate Christmas Nathan, the day after Christmas. Our oldest child's name is Eve. Nathan got so upset when he was 2 that she had her own day, so we gave him one too. Jessica says, my girls would say bicept. It was a mix of accept and besides, and we still use it 15 years later. Janine says, my mother-in-law asked my hubby what he got for his birthday. He replied, a bathtub, when he got a backpack. To this day, we call his backpack a bathtub. And Deanna emailed, my daughter called police officers gas hoppers. No clue where she got that from. That's weird. Made everyone laugh and still does. Makes me laugh. Keep them coming over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time.